Hi, welcome to the call. Welcome back to the World Peace Diet Facilitator Training. This is session number 10. We're up to 10 already. And just keep in mind the download for the resources for February 2012 are in your membership site under today's session with Dr. Will Tuttle. Thanks for being here. And let's welcome to the call our host, Dr. Will Tuttle.
Well, thank you, Steve, and I'd like to really welcome everyone to our call. Thanks, everyone, for joining us this evening. It's February 23rd, 2012, and things are just accelerating, it seems to me, on every level in our culture, especially in regards to the awakening of our collective consciousness about our mistreatment of animals for food and other products. And so it's really great to be part of this, and I want to thank each and every one of you for the efforts that you're making, because I know it's a lot more than we can really understand. I know all of you are working in lots of ways, both individually, one-on-one, and also writing and speaking and thinking about these things and engaging in your communities to help spread the vegan message of compassion for all living beings. And so I'm really honored to be able to be part of this wonderful community. I want to thank especially Steve for doing this great work of all of the logistics behind the scenes, and again emphasize two things. Number one, if you have any questions as we're going on tonight, or really any time, about getting on to the forums or into the membership site or seeing what's happening, what the schedule is and all that, Steve has been fantastic at just responding immediately and answering questions, and so really grateful for that. And also to just remind you that we have events coming up in the next few days, so several different ones. This weekend I'll be speaking as part of the Conscious Foods Summit, which is a pretty neat thing put on by the Shift Network, which is a pretty large-scale organization, and it's nice to see them actually including in their efforts to bring peace to the world, bringing the vegan message in, because typically that never happens. So Steve has been helping with that, and I think it's just indicative of the fact that people are starting to make these important connections. So we have a wonderful guest with us this evening. It's for the beginning part of our call, and I think you are all aware of that. It's Dr. Jonathan Balcom from the Washington, D.C. metro area, and I've had a chance to meet Jonathan a few times. It's always great to see him and to learn more about his work. So before I introduce him, which I'm going to do in just a short minute here, I'd like to just invite all of us, as we begin our time together, to do something that I just feel is so helpful, because I think there's a sense, at least that I have, sitting here sort of alone and with a phone in my hand and talking and knowing that we are connected, that just take a moment and just feel into that for a moment, that we're connected with each other, and not only with each other through this call, but at a deeper level through our aspirations for creating a world of greater compassion and sustainability and freedom and peace and equality and justice. And it's not just those of us who are on this call, but there will be many more people joining us, people who will be listening to the recording of this in the future, all of our friends from Europe and other parts of the world who listen in the next day, and other people who will be joining us. And not only all those people, but the people who we are interacting with and spreading them our message, and all the people who are working on this in their own ways and who we may only connect with through our thoughts and feelings and our yearnings. And perhaps we'll see the results of their actions when we watch a video or read an article or hear about a news item. You know, it's just amazing things. I just got one today about the new world wrestling champion being a vegan and wanting some guy who wants to spread compassion for animals through being the world wrestling champion. I mean, it's really amazing how this is happening. So let's just give thanks for this network that's growing and expanding, feel our connection with the earth, this beautiful living, breathing planet that we're part of so intimately, that supports us every breath, every bite of food and every drink of water, and all our relations with all beings here. Give thanks for the spiritual component, the eternal consciousness that is shining forth through us in our lives, and for this precious opportunity of a human birth to help bring a world of greater awareness into fruition, that we have a mission for this lifetime, for this incarnation, and the mission we each have, of course, is intimately known only to ourselves, but that we can together reinforce our missions. And I think there's probably nothing more noble or greater anyone can do than to come to this planet, to come to a planet anyway in outer space, and pitch in to help relieve suffering. So thank you all for joining us. And without further ado, I'd like to jump into our wonderful opportunity that we have this evening to hear a little bit from Jonathan Balcom. I'll say a few words about Jonathan here as, by way of introduction. You're probably all aware of some of these things, but just very briefly, he is an ethologist, an animal behavior scientist who has been studying animal behavior for many years, and rather than keeping his findings confined to the stuffy academic journals, as often is the case, he's been publishing them far and wide and to people. And I've heard Jonathan speak on NPR, I've heard him speak at Farm Sanctuary, and I've just actually had a chance to read his newest book, which is called The Exultant Ark. It's really beautiful. And I've also read his book called The Second Nature, and so and Pleasurable Kingdom. So actually, you know, it's great to see these ideas, I think, going into the mainstream. So Jonathan is an animal behaviorist. His best-selling books, Pleasurable Kingdom and Second Nature, really present animals in a new light. And he is making himself available, really, to this very challenging task of bringing this message of a new way of seeing animals into the public eye. And as you all know who have read the World Peace Diet, I devote quite a bit of writing in one of the chapters, Science and Religion, to the way the attitude of scientists has been changing. So without any further ado, I'd like to welcome Jonathan Balcom to our call. And welcome, Jonathan. Good to have you here with us.
Great to be here, Will. Thanks.
Great. Hi. And I also want to say, just I forgot to say this earlier, everyone, you probably know, some of you may be on this call possibly for the first time, as we have people coming on all the time, to remind you to please ask questions. If you have any question of Jonathan, you can either just press star 2 on your phone, and we will see it here in the secret underground headquarters where we see everything. We'll see the little light go on next to your phone number, and that way we'll be able to call on you. Or if you'd like, if you're at your computer and listening to the call there, you can also just type it in. There's a place, I think it should be obvious where it is. Go ahead and type it in. So if you have any questions for Jonathan, please don't hesitate. This is a wonderful opportunity. Jonathan is a very well-respected scientist. And, okay, so I'd like to just go ahead and open up the question by just asking, I'll open up the subject by asking a question of you, Jonathan, that I think you've probably heard before. But how do you see the essential landscape of our culture's orientation towards animals, and especially the scientific orientation towards animals, changing? And what do you think? That's of course part A. And then how do you feel we can contribute to that in a positive way? But I'd love to hear what's going on right now, really, from your perspective in the scientific community, because I think it's probably quite a bit of discussion and so forth going on. So please just enlighten us about that.
Sure. Well, I share your excitement about the changes that are beginning to really show up. As a subscriber to Veg News magazine, I find that's like as good as any a reminder of some of the really positive trends that are going on in terms of awareness about animals and what we eat and how that affects them and how we live. Of course, there's a great deal of work to be done. So in terms of science and in terms of our relationship to animals, my take on it is that we have a huge disconnect. But the good news is that, so that's the bad news. The good news is that we're increasingly becoming aware of that disconnect. The disconnect is that it's a very exciting time to be an ethologist, to study animal behavior, because unlike the first half of the last century, scientists are now asking questions about animals that are much more revealing and interesting. They're asking questions about animal minds and animal emotions, animal feelings. And animals are scientifically becoming much more sentient than they once were. Of course, they've always been sentient. It's a matter of how we think about them.
Right.
The huge disconnect is that as this information comes to light, our current relationship, which is still very much in a might makes right take as we can, almost like it's going back to colonialism and the slave trade, it's still very much in that of that ilk. So as this information comes to light, the way that we still currently, the paradigm of mistreatment of animals and exploitation of animals becomes more clearly wrong. And so, you know, information is powerful, and the information is there, the information is coming out, and as the information comes out, I think that's the groundwork for the sea change that we're all hoping for, that I feel is inevitable. I mean, it's not sustainable to relate to animals the way we have been anymore. And so I'm very hopeful. You know, we can talk about how long it'll take, but I'm certainly hopeful that things are moving in the right direction and that there is going to be a fundamental paradigm shift in the relatively near future.
Right. So what do you think... I guess the question that comes up for me is that, you know, science does not operate in a vacuum. These people who are scientists are typically going home and eating animals and then, you know, exposed in a sense, I guess, to the same kinds of disconnects that we all are. Do you think scientists are, you know, tend to be more open to the vegan message, say, than others since they're studying animals, or do you think they're perhaps less open because they are studying animals? I mean, have you seen, how does it look to you when you look to the other, say, ethologists in general, or you know, do you see yourself as being, you know, well-respected or for your position, or do you see that they just really don't want to hear what you have to say too much?
Back to the first part of your question, I mean, it really depends on the scientist. A growing number of scientists are more concerned than before, and scientists are intelligent people. They're usually critical thinkers. Scientists know that you've got to ask questions, and skepticism is an important part of science. I'm happy to say that I spoke at a conference in Germany in 2009, and I wonder to this day if it was the first time in history that there were two vegan scientists who spoke one after another at a science conference, because the guy who spoke directly before me is a self-professed vegan. And so I thought, you know, there's a good sign of the times. And I just returned from speaking at a couple of universities in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Yesterday I returned. And there were some scientists in the audience, and they seemed pretty receptive, and I got to sit down and talk with one, and he believes that the paper wasps he studies have feelings, and that to me is also a sign of progress. So yeah, they're a mixed bag like anyone else. You mentioned a wrestler who's a vegan, and, you know, that's not what you typically associate with the stereotype of a wrestler. Or an ultimate cage fighter, or a football player, or a baseball player, and yet we hear growing numbers of these individuals who are seeking a plant-based diet, not always for ethical reasons, but it could be for health reasons, but it's all the same for the animals in the short term. And often, I think, an interesting psychological phenomenon is that once you make that switch away from eating animals, you no longer are wedded to all the psychological justifications you need to have or that you used to have for eating them. And once that veil is lifted, your defenses are no longer there, and people seem to be much more open to embracing all the other good reasons to not eat animals. So, and scientists are critical thinkers too, as I say. So I think they're very open to making that transition. It's the information that's powerful, and we need to keep getting the information out there.
Right. What about the fact, I mean, people are very aware of this, I think, I'm sure you are too, of the fact that corporate money, you know, the money and power of corporations has invaded in many ways the scientific establishment in a very meaningful, significant way, to the degree that it's pretty well known that a lot of studies are bought and paid for by corporate money to get the kinds of results they want to get, and do you think that this is militating against scientists seeing animals as conscious beings, sentient beings, because there's so much money that is made by corporations on animals? I mean, I know that, you know, the food industry and all the industries really fund experiments on animals a lot, and there's a so I guess the question is about the corporate funding.
Well, you know, truth has a way of bubbling to the surface, and while there may be some scurrilous individuals who are twisting the quote-unquote science for political reasons, most scientists in an academic institution are nevertheless divorced from that type of activity, and I think most scientists are truly seeking truth, if you like. It's just the nature of science and how they've been doing it in the past, and science certainly is definitely subject to the winds of social mores of the time, which is why it's very significant that it's no longer taboo to study animal feelings. And so because of that, science has been revealing, as I describe in my books, and continues to reveal at an increasing pace, aspects of animals' lives that were used to be, you would have been considered fantasy just a generation ago. So sure, while there is some misinformation out there, I think most of the information coming out of science is honest. It may be tainted by this old paradigm that we've had, but increasingly I think that paradigm is beginning to melt away. And I meet more and more young scientists especially. You know, these are people who've come up, who've grown up with a vibrant social movement in the books, in the papers. It may be misrepresented sometimes. I'm talking about the, you know, the vegetarian movement, the vegan movement, the animal rights movement, something that the previous generation did not grow up with. And that's another
right.
source of legitimacy, is when something is being discussed. And, you know, you may have heard of that, you know, what John Stuart Mill said, all social movements go through three stages, ridicule, discussion, and adoption. Well, ridicule is long gone now.
Right.
We're talking about discussion now and beginning to see signs of adoption. So I think that, too, is very promising. And that shows itself in all walks of society, and science is no exception.
Right. So you don't think, then, that the actual power of corporate money, I mean, I'm sure it has some effect, but you think that the power of people, because I just see this quite a bit in terms of, you know, the media, and when someone funds a study, very often they have an axe to grind. But you don't see that happening so much in animal behavior, maybe in other things, pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, a faculty member at a university, you know, it is that publisher parish kind of environment
right.
for many scholars and many institutions. So there's definitely a motive, an impetus to get information out there. But usually it's the new, exciting, interesting findings that get the most attention. And scientists are, you know, like the rest of us, many people clamor for recognition and acknowledgement of their contributions. And so
right.
It means a lot to their careers to be revealing interesting new information. And a lot of the stuff about animal emotions and animal feelings is pretty new and exciting, because it's not that the subject is new. It's not that animals are newly expressing this stuff. It's just that it hasn't been explored before. So that's just another angle on why I think we can expect more and more interesting discoveries that will continue to sway public opinion about animals.
Right. And have you found that there are young people who are vegans or who are really outraged on some level about the mistreatment of animals for food in our society, are becoming animal scientists in order to address that? I mean, they're choosing that as one way. I mean, there's always all kinds of ways of going, but that's the people are actually opting to become biologists or animal ethologists for that reason.
Yeah, I am seeing that. I mean, I teach at Humane Society University, which is a startup university. We're fledgling. We just started offering degree courses in 2009. And, you know, incidentally, that's another sign of the times. You know, this is the first university dedicated to the animal issues. And we have, I'm the department chair for animal studies. I teach a course in animal behavior and animal minds and animal protection. Animal protection infuses all of what we teach. And a lot of our students are scientifically trained or in the process of becoming scientists and very interested in science, and are certainly in my department the courses we teach are very scientifically informed. And so that's perhaps a little bit beyond your question in the sense that these are not all scientists, but we also need a scientifically literate society, a society that understands science and how science works. That's all to the good, because once again, back to that comment, you know, the truth having a way of bubbling to the surface. It sounds self-righteous, but I'm going to say it anyway. The truth is on our side here. Animals are sentient. Animals suffer. Animals can also feel pleasure. Their lives matter. And sentience is the bedrock of ethics. And so it's so clearly wrong the way when we treat animals ill, and it's so clearly better on so many fronts when we treat them well, which, of course, includes not eating them. And so that's a truth that I do have great faith is going to find its way to the surface. It already is. And that's the source of some positive change in the years ahead.
Right. What about, shifting gears a little bit here, about the fact that a lot of what we know, unfortunately, about animals comes from confining them in laboratory settings of some kind or another. I mean, some of the studies that come out showing the intelligence of pigs or whatever it is, these animals are suffering by being confined and experimented on to understand them. What do you think about the ethics of that kind of experimentation?
Yeah, I often get asked that because I speak about studies, some of which are not very nice to the animals, and they're not studies that I would approve if I was sitting on an animal care and use committee and deliberating over these research proposals. Nevertheless, I mean, my response to that is that I will use whatever information is available to me to plead the animal's case, and given that those studies are done out of my power, if they help me to do that, I will use them. Nonetheless, a lot of studies can be done. I mean, we can. It's not like, you know, it's sort of a tired old line from the biz sector. You know, if we stopped researching on animals, science would grind to a halt. It's a lot of codswallop. They like to say that. But a lot of science, a lot of the scientific research that's done with animals is not harmful, or at least not severely harmful. There may be some temporary short-term interferences with animals, even just observer effects when you're watching animals in the wild, although if you spend a lot of time around them, they get used to your presence if you're benign. And a lot of the research I cite is of that nature, and some of the best stuff is of that nature. The discovery of bereavement in mother baboons, it's a sad subject, but you know, that was done by looking at hormone levels in their feces. You didn't even have to touch the animal, and these are wild, free-ranging animals. And by studying them in that way, very hands-off, of course, you're looking at a much more pure animal, an animal who's untainted by the artificialities of captivity. And lo and behold, the information you get is going to be much more accurate for that reason. And it's a compelling finding, both the physiological and behavioral responses to this grievous loss. We know it's a grievous loss to lose a child, is very closely mirrored in baboons with humans. So it appears they have a similar emotional response to that loss.
Right. So what do you see your mission or your goal or whatever, you know, in the work you're doing? Is it to try to, I'll just leave it at that. What do you see as your goal of the work you're doing?
There's really one primary area that I like, that I feel like I'm the main contributor, and that is the realm of pleasure. It's just been neglected by science, and when I first thought about the subject when I was birdwatching 10 years ago, I almost fell over. It was such an epiphany, and so striking that I had spent 10 years in three different universities acquiring 3 degrees in biology, and I couldn't even think of a single occasion where animal behavior was put in the context of pleasure. And that was just amazing to me, because pleasure is so much a part of our lives. It informs so much, so many of the decisions we make on a day-to-day basis. Are we to really think that it doesn't inform a giraffe's life and a warthog's life and a peacock's life, and pick your animal? And so that, I like to think, is probably my main subject and main contribution, partly because it has been neglected. And so I'm really working hard to bring it to light through my writings and through my public speaking. Also, pleasure has a great deal of reach, moral reach, because it shows that animals' lives are worth living. It shows they have intrinsic value. They're not just pain avoiders, they're pleasure seekers. And a pleasurable life, pleasure is what makes life worth living. And so pleasure has a great deal of moral import to questions about death, not just suffering, or the avoidance of suffering, but, you know, death. The reason why murder is so harmful is because you're curtailing a life. And why is that bad? Well, the individual who dies is missing out on the rest of their life. And I think that's the crux of why murder is such a heinous crime. And so it has a great deal of moral implications. But also, I think it can really enrich our view of nature. And the other related subject that I may have sort of alluded to is our view of wild nature needs to be revised. It's so often presented as a constant, earnest struggle for survival, red in tooth and claw, predator-prey relationships, parasites, and all the like. And while it's not a bowl of cherries in life, for us as well as other animals, there's a great deal of positive things, aspects to animals' lives, be they wild or domesticated. Well, the animals caught up in the meat trade, there's not so much positive there, of course, but animals can and do reap a great deal of rewards in their lives through just routine survival things such as food, shelter and comfort, the need to stay warm when it's cold or vice versa, sex, of course, touch, companionship, love, freedom, you know, the ineffable quality of freedom for those who have it, I think in itself is a source of great pleasure. So that's meaningful to me for two reasons. One is it's something that's been neglected, and it really raises animals' profile in terms of their capacity for life and a joyous life, a life that has meaning. And it contradicts the old view that nature is harsh and cruel, which I think is a little bit of an old excuse. It makes us feel comfortable and feel a little bit less culpable and guilty for treating them ill as we have done for so long.
So you think that's maybe one of the reasons behind that basic teaching that nature is violent and animals are always terrified or are fighting or struggling, and if we treat them badly, it's actually not as badly as they would have been treated when they were out in the wild, right? Yeah, I think that old illusion dies pretty hard, I think, but it helps.
It was used as Darwin's findings, you know,
right.
Evolution by natural selection was used as an excuse by the social Darwinists to defend the workshops and the workhouses that they had in the late Victorian era, where child labor was being used. And it's like, well, nature's competitive, and this is a competitive world we live in, and if I'm to get the upper hand, if I'm to be competitive and successful in my business, I just have to do this, and it's part of nature, and therefore it's legitimate and okay. So, yeah, there's definitely political ramifications to this worldview of wild nature as a cruel, harsh place.
Right, right. Also used for humans to justify human slavery too, as I've talked about. One other quick question here about: do you have anything to recommend to people who are, like, people on this call are not typically scientists, but we're all interested in advocating the vegan message, and some of the ways that science we can use. I guess we can use science in order to do that. One of the things I know that people run into quite a bit is just simply people saying, "Oh, you vegans, you know, you're against vivisection and you're against progress, you know, that kind of thing." And also people who have a lot of issues with dissection, you know, having their kids dissecting animals in school. What can we do as vegan animal rights activists? Is it important for us to stay in, up with the science, and what can we do to help this change move along?
Yeah, I think it is important for us to stay up with the science, and hopefully I think the science is going to be more and more on our side, which is to say on the animal side. I'm being pretty positive in this interview, but there's a lot of reasons to be positive. And so I think for the public, I would say read books like mine, which are a nice summary of the animals' capacities. I think if we're vegans, if we're animal defenders, we're often on the defense because, although I have to say I'm not on the defense that much, but people are curious and they're also ignorant. Not to be anti-people, but you know, we tend to be ignorant of things, and there's a lot of ignorance about animals, and it's partly a result, I think, of the way we're raised to treat them. We block out useful information, and so anyway, I think it behooves us all as friends of animals to be up to speed, or at least be somewhat informed of the new discoveries about animal sentience and animal cognition, animal minds, what they can do and how animals feel. And that's the main purpose of my books. They summarize some of the recent scientific findings that are revealing in that way. And my books are on a mission, as I am. It's not just information. There's a take-home message. It's like, this is what we can do with this information, and this is what we need to do with it. So I think that's where we can really leverage scientific discovery in our favor. You don't have to be a scientist, but if you know a few examples that, you know, that rats laugh, and that, that you know, I mentioned the baboons who grieve the loss of a young one, and that cows get excited when they solve a problem, And chickens have a vocabulary of 30 words. Use deception, and they're Machiavellian in their intelligence, and even fishes.
Who's this fish?
Studies of cognition in fishes, and they have remarkable memories. And I'm actually developing a new talk about fishes because they've been
They feel pain too. I mean, a lot of people don't think that they really can feel pain since they look so kind of cold and voiceless and so forth. I mean, I hear this all the time when I talk to people who are fishing.
It's no longer really controversial.
Can't feel pain.
Oh, yeah. And I think that comes back to the juncture between information and the power that it has. Most people don't know about the fish pain studies. Once they know, it's a big bit of a jolt, and it's a big piece of information that can really be used to benefit fishes.
Right.
I'm glad you mentioned it, fishermen.
Right. Yeah. It's something they don't like to think about, obviously, but important. Well, it's been really, really great to have a chance to talk to you about these, this perspective you have. And does anyone have any other? I'm kind of waiting. Sometimes people are shy. So you're a scientist. I think people are going into the mode of like, oh, what am I going to? Oh, here's a question. Okay. Yes, Grace. You have a question for Jonathan?
Yes, I do. Thank you. Good evening.
Hi.
I'm sorry to admit I have not read your books yet. I did watch a YouTube video and your presentation in Hawaii at the Veg Society there. I really, really enjoyed that. And I was hoping that you would please share some examples of some scientific research highlighting the pleasure that animals experience, because as you said earlier in the call, I think it gives more moral weight to the fact that they can enjoy life. So, you know, occasionally when I'm speaking with individuals, I'll mention the gratuitous sex and that awesome experiment. I can't remember exactly where I read it, maybe in Thanking the Monkey or possibly in the book by Doctors Greek and Greek, that experiment where I think it was macaws, one was going to get shocked if the other pushed the button to get the food, and the monkeys would go hungry rather than shock the monkey that they could see. And that touches a lot of people. But and also that when they were switched places, the monkeys that had been on the shocked side were even more likely to go hungry or starve. Rather than push the button in order to get the food. Anyway, I wanted to focus more on the pleasure since that's your specialty. Thank you so much for what you do. Would you be able to please just give me a couple of examples of scientific studies that I could share very casually?
Sure, I'd be happy to, and you clearly already accumulated some examples of other animal studies. Some, as you say, are quite disturbing. That the rat studies you mentioned go date back to the late 50s and early 60s. A variation on that that is less disturbing was a recent study showing empathy in rats in which or helping behavior, spontaneous helping behavior, where a rat who was stuck in a glass cylinder wanted to get out. Obviously, another rat would come and really open the cylinder and let the rat out before going and getting some chocolate, and they would share the chocolate and that sort of thing. That's, again, that's not really so much an animal pleasure study, although, you know, animal social behavior leads to a lot of virtuous behavior. It's another aspect of animal behavior that's been overlooked until recently. Okay, so a couple of quick examples about animal pleasure. A series of studies have been done on rats to show that they show a mirthful response to being tickled. They spend a lot of time, particularly when they're young, engaging in rough and tumble play, and they have specific sort of maneuvers, and it's a very fluid type of social interaction where there's give and take, and the bigger rat will compromise themselves so that it's more of an even wrestling match, but it's fun. They're uttering huge numbers of 50 kilohertz chirps, which are outside of our range of hearing, so you have to use special devices to hear them, but they're making lots of those, and those are all associated with pleasure. And the rats will actually run to the hand if they're expecting to be tickled in the belly rather than merely petted on the neck. They will come for both, but they will run much faster. And so a series of studies have been done on that. An example from reptiles, which we so often dismiss as cold-blooded, unfeeling animals. Iguana lizards, for instance, will trade off. They will make a cost-benefit sort of assessment on whether to go and get a treat. They'll venture away from their warm sun lamp where there's nutritionally complete reptile chow to go into a refrigerator at the other end of their terrarium to pick up a piece of lettuce, which for them is a gourmet tidbit, especially if you're fed boring reptile chow day in and day out. And then they'll bring it back to the sun lamp and eat it. And depending on how much you offer them and how cold it is and that sort of thing, they'll make a flexible decision on whether to get the food or not, the treat. So they weigh the costs of getting a pleasure as we do, and it shows a flexible side to a reptile's behavior that we often don't attribute to a reptile. There are tons of other studies, and I summarize them in my book, Pleasurable Kingdom. And there's a lot of them. Some of them are sort of repeated studies done in very controlled settings, but some of them are observations in nature, such as the fish cleaning stations, where fishes will line up to wait their turn to be plucked over and given a spa treatment by cleaner fishes. And it's a mutualism. The client gets a, like I say, a spa treatment and a cleaning service, and the cleaner fish gets a little bit of a nutritional reward, and they clean hundreds, sometimes thousands of other fishes each day. It's sort of their business relationship and the way they make their living. And there are many, many other examples of touch-mediated pleasurable mutualisms in nature, be between fish and mammals and mammals and mammals and birds, and the list goes on. So there's a lot out there. There's a lot of pleasure stuff, but that's just a couple of examples.
Great. Thanks, Jonathan. I also, if you want to go to YouTube, and we just saw this a couple of days ago, it's a great little video from Russia of a crow sliding down a snowy roof on a little disc, and then after that picks up the disc, goes back up, does it again, picks it up, goes back up, does it again. It's really cute to see how, you know.
Remarkable video, isn't it? It went viral.
Yeah.
And really telling elements about that. I mean, I doubt very much that crow found that jar lid on the roof, which means that he or she carried it up there.
Brought it up.
Probably meant planning, right, and intent. And then if you've seen the version where the crow flies off, the crow doesn't leave the lid there. He or she takes the lid with them. So, yeah, YouTube is another great tool. It's showing people aspects,
yeah,
of animal behavior that we didn't realize they had.
That's true. It's really helping. We have a question, couple questions here. One, this one, I guess, don't take, you know, well, I'll just let you answer how you want, but from Beth, she says, please share the main qualities and descriptions you would tell people about chickens, turkeys, cows, pigs, sheep, goats, and fish. In other words, you know, the animals we eat for food. What are the main qualities and descriptions you could give people? I'm assuming she means, you know, relatively briefly, if you just, you know, in a discussion, what could we say about these animals that are bear the brunt of ferocity in our culture?
Sure, I'll be very brief. I mean, the words that come to my mind are sentient, aware, cognitive, meaning able to think, perceptive. It's such an important thing. we so often hold ourselves at the top of the pyramid, and yet our vision is very run-of-the-mill. Well, we're very visual. It's quite good, actually, as far as animals go, but there are some animals who have far better vision than us. And hearing and sense of smell. So perceptions, I love what D.H. Lawrence wrote of the fish in his poem, Fish. He describes the fish's life as a sluice of sensation along your sides, and that speaks to the sort of physicality of living in the water. And so animals are very touch-sensitive, and so I would add that to the list, very, very touch-sensitive.
Right, and also I think it's important to remember that animals like cows through millions of years have learned not to vocalize if they're feeling pain, because that would draw attention to them and draw attention to their children. And so just because they don't vocalize when they're in pain, unless it's really bad, but you know, people think that they don't feel anything. And I think, you know, those kinds of things are important.
Stoicism is adaptive.
Right. Yeah, exactly. We have someone else here who has from Oregon. I'll go ahead, Steve, can you unmute? Question?
I recently attended a KS Wild meeting where they were talking about the bills about the wolves and the cougars. That's part of my question is, how do you feel about these endangered species being hunted for pleasure, and what can we do? I mean, we all sat down and wrote letters to our congresspeople and senators and got those mailed off to help protect the wolves, especially the one that's gone down into California to look for a mate. Now he's headed back up to Washington and Oregon again. But my other question is having to do with Rupert Sheldrake, who wrote Seven Experiments That Can Change the World, and then, of course, he wrote the book after that called The Greening of God and Science, and he came up with the morphic fields. But he put forth quite a bit in The Greening of God and Science about animals having emotions. And do you know him, or would you care to comment on any of his early work?
Sure. I'll respond to that question first. I have met Rupert Sheldrake. He actually came to a lecture I gave in London a couple of years ago, and I had been at one of his lectures about 10 years earlier, and I have read Seven Experiments That Could Change the World. I haven't read The Greening. I think he's a very interesting man. I admire him for tackling very unpopular ideas that science tends to shy away from. Things like morphic fields and animals' homing ability. I mean, scientists are interested in that, but they don't like to go beyond anything that's sort of really very palpably physical in its explanation, and Sheldrake seems to venture courageously beyond that. And then the other issue you raised, wolves and cougars and, you know, endangered species, of course it's an absolute outrage that there should be anyone who thinks it's okay to persecute these animals. I mean, for me, and I suspect you and probably most listeners in this call, regardless of whether the animal is endangered, it's wrong to go and persecute them. But it's particularly outrageous that people can shoot these animals from helicopters, and we've already extirpated them from almost the entire lower 48 states historically where they used to live. And as soon as they start making a comeback, thanks to the Endangered Species Act and perhaps other efforts, as soon as they start making a comeback, there's always some faction of society, the Sarah Palin types, who are clamoring to have their opportunity to go back and start killing them again, which is such a Little Red Riding Hood, old-school way of viewing these animals anyway. There's almost no records of any kind of attacks of these animals on us, which even then, again, wouldn't, in my view, justify us persecuting them. But nonetheless, there's really no basis for it, except for an anthropocentric worldview, a view that says we are all that matters, their lives are unimportant, and that's a kind of view we have to combat. So the way to stop that, I think, is long-term efforts. We can protest now, and that's important, but we also need to change laws, and we need to get the information out there that these animals have lives worth living.
Thank you. Do you know Washington, Oregon, and California now have laws to protect the sharks so that they cannot be killed for their fins?
I heard about the California law. I had not heard about the Washington or Oregon.
It's all three states.
Good. Well, let's hope it's all 50 soon.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. Okay, we have one more person with his or her hand up. We'll go ahead and unmute. I don't have any. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi, Will.
Yes.
This is Veronica. First of all, I want to apologize because I'm literally on the street waiting for a bus stop, so there's a lot of traffic noise. So I apologize if there's a lot of noise on the line. Question is, can you hear me well, first of all?
Yes, I can hear you okay.
Okay, good. I'm going to try to be as clear as possible because I know there's a lot of noise. My question was, I heard you mention, Doctor, earlier that you have a lot of hope about the scientific community changing its views. I know that the American Anti-Vivisection Society is pretty good at giving materials in schools for children to learn about animal anatomy, which doesn't include vivisection, and they've been very aggressive at trying to promote these materials. I was wondering, you said you were very hopeful, but I was wondering if you could elaborate on this, because you're on the inside and we're on the outside, and it's very hard for us to see any real changes from where we stand. It doesn't look like there is really any changes from the scientific community. Anytime I pick up an article about some research, they always mention animal testing, animal, vivisection or whatever to back up any research they're doing. So I was wondering if you could elaborate on that.
I'll do my best. There certainly are steps forward and steps backwards, and it does seem frustratingly slow that whatever progress may be happening in regards to the use of harmful use of animals in education and also the harmful use of animals in research and testing. And nonetheless, there are victories in there. There are animal tests non-animal tests that have replaced animal tests. It seems that the European Union is the leader now in so many of these sweeping reforms that are beginning to take place, where, for instance, the use of chimpanzees has been banned in many parts of the world, and the U.S. is sadly the last holdout, really, which is shameful for us, given that we're such a progressive and outspoken country, and we value freedom and that sort of thing. And then the intractable issue of dissection, which I think is a very significant one, because it's impressionable minds who have this whole might makes right relationship reinforced when they have a frog plunked down in front of them. And many kids studies show that a lot of kids have misgivings about this, but they're not given the opportunity to express those misgivings. I think it's a really egregious practice, the use of animal dissections, on so many fronts, and that's one that seems so winnable.
Right.
But it's remarkable how tenacious tradition can be. But I would like to see more efforts in that area, and I know the Humane Education Society is one who've done a lot of good in that. I worked on that issue for many years, and nonetheless, there are positive changes, laws passing, being passed. 30 years ago, I think only one state had the beginnings of a law to provide choice for students, and now I think it's about 15. So that's a pretty important change, and we need to grab those changes and leverage them and build more and keep working on state legislatures to add these laws.
Right. Thank
you. Just one other
so
comment.
Much,
a positive sign, there have been experiments that have been halted in Switzerland and I think Germany, where vivisector who was doing monkey experiments was informed that he could not continue the experiments because it was deemed they were not contributing enough to our knowledge to justify the suffering that the animals were being exposed to.
Fantastic. Great. Thank you so much. I know we've been going on here quite a while, probably I should never say long enough because this is really interesting. Are you willing to take two more quick questions? I've got two more people that have questions.
I'll take as many as you have.
Yeah.
Be happy to.
All right. Okay. Well, we have a question here from Nina. How do you address, that she typed in, how do you address the argument that animals are not self-aware and don't recognize their own reflection in a mirror?
Well, actually, several animals have been shown to pass the so-called mirror self-recognition test. Elephants, dolphins, the great apes, and in 2008, the first bird, which was a magpie, or several magpies, For those who may not know, this test is where a mark is put surreptitiously on the animal and the animal is given a mirror, and if the animal attempts to remove the mark, then that's evidence that the animal recognizes it's themselves. If they make a threat display or look behind the mirror, it suggests they may not recognize themselves. And so it's considered a pretty rigorous demonstration that the animal has a sense of self. I will add that failing this test shouldn't be viewed as an indicator necessarily that the animal isn't self-aware.
Right.
It's not the be-all, end-all way to show it. But in any event, there are
some
animals...
They may not know it's a mirror, exactly. I mean, the technology...
Yeah, they may not have been exposed to mirrors before. Even, you know, human tribes who've been confronted with mirrors often don't sort of relate to them in what we might regard as appropriate way right away. So anyway, there are animals that are self-aware. But even beyond that, let's say an animal fails this test and doesn't show much sign of self-awareness. It doesn't mean they're not sentient. It doesn't mean they might have other kinds of awareness and consciousness and emotions. So it's certainly not the only attribute that we should hold dear and important in terms of how we treat animals.
Right, and you could also say that there are certain people who, you know, for whatever reason, diseases or mental retardation or whatever, could also be said not to be self-aware, I guess, perhaps.
But yeah, the argument for marginal cases is one of the stiffest challenges to the old speciesist view that we're the only ones that matter, because you can always find examples of humans, as you say, Will. You can find examples of humans who don't have, they're mentally enfeebled for various reasons. Do we think we should... you know, incarcerate them and kill them and eat them and all the other things we do to animals? Of course, we recoil in shock and horror at the very idea of it. And so it really exposes the two-faced nature of a lot of our so-called moral beliefs about animals.
Right. Great, thanks. And then this one is a little bit longer. I'll just go ahead and read it. It's from Gypsy Wolf in Australia. Hi, Jonathan. It's an Aussie friend of yours here. It's just been wonderful to hear you on the show. Can you share your understanding of animal communication in terms of how they let each other know about food choices? We have an abundance of doves in our garden who are nowhere to be seen when we forget to put wild bird seed out. And yet within half an hour of filling the feeders, one appears and then up to a half a dozen at a time. Oh, I've seen that with ants. I mean, it's amazing. I don't know how they do it. Any ideas on how this amazing network works from your studies? Many thanks for the wonderful work you offer through your books, Activism and Special Heart for the Animals.
Thanks, Gypsy. I've yet to meet Gypsy in person, but we have had a Skype call, and I admire the work that she's doing in Australia.
Yeah, she's doing great stuff, right? Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think what goes on there, this is an illustration of the benefits of social living, which many animals have evolved to have, including us, because living in social groups allows for the more efficient and quick exchange of information. And I think no better example than the honeybee, which has this remarkably sophisticated communication system, the waggle dance, in which they can convey specific information about the distance, the direction, and the quality of, say, a cluster of flowers out there a mile and a half northeast from the hive. And it's just amazing what they do, and they continue to amaze us in their ability to do that. And so, in fact, I cannot resist to give you just one example of the spooky abilities that bees have. One study showed that if you put, and I'll just sort of make this up arbitrarily, but if you put sugar water, which is the standard food that's given to bees in these studies, if you put sugar, a little dish of sugar water, say, 100 yards due east of the hive on Monday, and then on Tuesday morning you put sugar water 200 yards due east, and then on Wednesday 300 yards due east, by Thursday morning the bees are actually waiting at the point 400 yards due east from the hive, because they've figured out the pattern and they know it's coming. So bees actually have this ability to predict the location of food. So I just give that as sort of an anecdote for an invertebrate. An animal doesn't even have a spine, doesn't even have a backbone, how remarkably complex and effective their communication can be. So those doves you're seeing are probably getting the word out. And you may ask the question, well, why tell others? Why not try and keep all the food to yourself? And there may be cases in nature when sometimes an animal will try and do that. But more often than not, and this speaks to the virtue and some of the more likable aspects of animals, that it's better for them and they would rather share it with friends, with other members of their family, of their species, than have it all to themselves. And there are benefits for that as well, of course, many social and survival benefits.
Right. Excellent. Well, that's fascinating. One other question's come in from Beth. I'm involved in trying to get an art project stopped where chickens will be paraded in public, then killed and eaten. What would you say to help save these chickens from slaughter for art?
Well, as a scientist, I would, of course, probably use my knowledge of chicken abilities, you know, what the chickens have lives that matter to them, that they can feel pleasures, that they have complex communication calls and that sort of thing. That's you know, we use our strengths. But certainly, you know, making a stink, letters to the editor and whatever might work locally and working with other groups and trying to get publicize this and put a stop to it, you know, the usual kind of thing. It is a shame that these things happen and that some scurrilous artists with not a lot of moral fiber are trying to capitalize literally on the backs of animals through their work and right. through the controversy of what they're doing to try and get notoriety that way. So use whatever tools you have available, but certainly, again, information is power, and I would use information as one of the tools to try and get it stopped.
Great. Wow. Well, thanks. We really appreciate your generous sharing with us. I'd like to thank you for joining us, Jonathan, and really encourage everyone to, when you have a chance, read some of Jonathan's books or look at his videos or find out more, because it's fascinating. I have to say, the new book, which is called The Exultant Ark, is really beautifully illustrated. So you not only do you get all of these, a lot of information about animal behavior, and especially about their lives, celebrating their lives and the pleasure that they're obviously experiencing, but some just gorgeous photos of animals from all over the world that, as they say, a picture is worth 10,000 words. And so thanks, Jonathan, for creating all these helpful artifacts to share the message with. It's really fantastic.
Well, you're welcome, Will, and thanks for having me on the show. And it was really especially nice to hear from some of your listeners.
Right. Yeah, it was. It was great. Great questions, everyone. All right, Jonathan, thanks. Thanks for joining us. It's been great, and we'll be in touch. Okay, so thank you, everyone, for your participation. Yeah, either directly or indirectly with your attention and just opening up to these ideas. It's really fascinating. It's one of the things I'll just say now myself that I think underlies really the message that we're all exploring and trying to bring to our world, the fact that we're born into a culture where we are forced as little children to eat the flesh and secretions of the animals who are harmed so badly in the process, that we learn to just disconnect from seeing them as sentient beings. And it's very reminiscent, really, of what happened to black people, you know, a couple hundred years ago. They were systematically just seen merely as inferior, merely as objects to be used. And the whole way of taking away the obvious sense that they're celebrating their lives, like in the case of animals in nature, in ways that are really beautiful. And one of the things that I just love to do, Madeline and I both together actually, is as we travel around the country, is to spend time in state parks. And I really encourage everyone to do this. To me, it's one of the, I think, most helpful things in being an effective advocate or activist for animals, is to see animals in the wild and to observe them and perhaps interact with them in some way. These animals in the wild, there's all kinds of animals in the wild. I mean, there are, you don't have to necessarily go on a safari to Africa to see elephants. I mean, there's all kinds of birds right outside the window. That's wildlife, snakes, even spiders and ants. I mean, basically, they are also living their lives freely, I just find I get very inspired and touched by observing them, and I think from my own perspective anyway, it's one of the main things that helps me and inspires me to continue to help, to do whatever I can to help relieve their suffering. And so I think even if we're living in somewhat urban environments, it's still possible to pay attention and see animals of all kinds around us. They are here. They are actually here. They're, in many ways, they're invisibilized. You know, we learn sort of not to see them, but I think to reconnect with them and to make an effort to reconnect with them is so rewarding. We went canoeing a few days ago with Judy Carman, who was hoping to be on this call. I don't see her on here, but we went up the Silver River in Florida, and besides seeing lots of birds and alligators and turtles and so forth, which was great, and otters, and I mean all kinds of animals. Really, it's a real wildlife refuge. We saw and really just watched for probably a good 45 minutes. The monkeys that lived there. Apparently, they were filming back in the 30s or 40s, and some monkeys get free, and they're living there. So it was just beautiful to see them grooming each other, and you know, the older ones just hanging out together and being loving with each other, and the young ones playing, jumping through the trees, leaping, and chasing each other, running around. You know, you can see. I mean, they're really living their lives, and to see the animals in this way, I think the more we do it, the more I think we can help create the field of wisdom and compassion in our culture. I know a lot of you are doing that in your own ways, and I just really think it's fantastic. And by the way, if you haven't had a chance, I wrote a piece recently, and it was put up on One Green Planet about going into nature, and you don't have to. I did it basically from the point of view of doing it like by oneself, and have a little video there too. So I have that on the resources for February, and encourage you if you're interested to have a look at it. But it doesn't have to be a big thing where you just go off by yourself for a few days in camp alone in nature. I think that's a great thing to do, but it may not be your thing at all. So, but there's all kinds of alternatives. You know, just go out and for an hour and spend time in nature. I think spending time in nature is one of the most healing and benevolent and beneficent things we can do, to actually see the animals and get inspired by them, and that gives us naturally a sense of wanting to protect them as well. So I wanted to really thank Jonathan for bringing up that point about how we're raised in a culture that traditionally, for just many, many centuries, sees animals as mere units of production. And I think really with the scientific revolution, it got much, much worse, because we developed the capacity to just hyper-confine the animals and learn to look with a real cold eye. You know, Rene Descartes and the whole development of the separation, really, of the mind and the body and the man, you know, humanity, men, basically, from nature. And the sense of animals being merely objects that don't have sentience. The world as a fall, the world as merely a mechanism, a biochemical, genetic, electrical sort of clockwork. It was great when I was getting my PhD at Berkeley, and I was able to study with Fritjof Capra, who if you ever have a chance to read The Turning Point, it was really a great book. I used it as a textbook when I was teaching college, but he shows how this mechanistic view of the world pervades all branches of science, from physics and biology as well as economics and social theory in general, and that what we're doing in many ways, I think, especially with our movement, is awakening the celebratory quality, as Thomas Berry also called it, the celebratory quality of nature, and to realize we're part of a living world, and that the more we see that and recognize that and see the beauty and nobility of other living beings, the more we will respect ourselves, and the more we'll be able to create social structures that respect ourselves. So the tricky part is bringing these ideas to people and bringing them to the world. That's our challenge. So we have lots of opportunities. If anyone has any questions or comments or things you want to emphasize, we have another, I would say, you know, maybe 15 minutes. I did want to talk briefly with Nina. I think, Nina, you're on the line, because we were talking a little bit sort of by email about something you're going to be doing in Massachusetts. And so if it's okay, We'll go ahead and Steve just unmuted your line. Would you mind just telling people a little bit of what you're up to there? Because I think it's very interesting and maybe something that we can be doing in other communities as well.
Hi, Will. Hi, everybody. Can you hear me?
Yes, perfect.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. It was just a wonderful to listen to tonight's interview. It was really inspiring. What we're doing in Massachusetts, we're kind of doing a lot of stuff. We are going to be attending the local vegetarian food festival with a table for the Circle of Compassion organization that you have to promote spirituality through our food choices and compassion to the animals, and also kind of act as a launching pad to broadcast some of your upcoming visits to our area.
Right, yeah. Mia works lives in central Massachusetts in the Worcester area, and yeah, I should just maybe let you know we just recently, probably in the last maybe 2 months or so, I guess, to maybe 3 months, were successful in getting Circle of Compassion as a 501c3 IRS accepted nonprofit organization. So with that, Nina has been able to get a discount rate on renting a table for this vegetarian food fest. So if anyone's interested in something like that, I think it's really a nice way to do outreach to people who are definitely interested, and we can make available literature and maybe some books and things like that. And if people, it's a good way perhaps to get interest in a World Peace Diet study group or in other ways of outreach and spreading the message into your community. And as luck would have it, Madeline and I are going to be heading up to New England in the summer, so I'll be able to give a few events in the area too later on in July, June, I think in July. And we're still living in the RV and traveling all over North America, so almost anywhere, wherever you are, we can come by there at some point in the next year and a half or 2 years. I think we're pretty flexible. We like to go where people have an interest, and Madeline loves to see the beautiful country here of America, and so do I. So just let us know if you'd like me to come to your area and do something, and we can talk on the forums or whatever. I guess that's probably the best way to share ideas about things like Nina's doing. Is there anything else, Nina, you want to say about it or anything else you're doing?
You
summed it up pretty well there. But
I just kind of wanted to share that all these events that we've been able to attend and that are planning in the future have all come about because partly because of just following intuition and sharing the talents that we have as a group together with the community. We have done outreach now through a religious service that one of the participants in my original World Peace Study group, her name is Lisa, went vegan from that participation in the first book study
Great.
Group. And now her and I, we've done 5 different churches where we're doing this service
Really?
On the World Peace Diet. Yep. And with the help of Veg Fund. And as part of that service, we sing songs of peace, which kind of snowballed into being invited to other churches to sing. The Unity Church in Worcester invited us to come sing. And then we had correspondence with you and them and some people there that were interested in your book. So it's like each experience is building off of the previous one. And I think if we just look at the talents that we have and keep our intentions that we'll find the path that is best suited for us to share the message with the world. And that was basically all I had to say.
Well, that's amazing. Yeah, so great. Well, thanks for sharing that. It's just great to hear. I know everyone's excited to find when there are these doorways open. And I think you're mentioning the idea of intuition, following that inner little what you love to do, what your abilities are, and what you enjoy doing, and sort of bringing that to bear to help animals and to help people and help the world, I think that's probably the foundation for living a happy, fulfilled life, because it doesn't mean life will necessarily be easy, but we'll have a sense of meaning and like we're contributing, and I think that's so precious. So thanks, Nina, for sharing that. And also just the idea that of bringing the message to religious groups, I think, is important. I mean, some people would rather bring it to into schools or on the Internet or whatever, but I think churches and religious groups of various kinds are a natural extension, a natural potential extension, and that's really where we work a lot, too. And the fact that you've been able to actually use music as a way to get in, and the message of veganism and the World Peace Diet to actually bring that in front of people. Unitarian churches are really good. Unity churches, I think, are good. I'm trying to a little bit to see if I can do something with the not the Mormons. What's the other
Seventh-day Adventists.
Seventh-day Adventists, right? Seventh-day Adventists. That's the here in Orlando. They started saying they were interested, and then they seemed to kind of get a little worried about having someone who was a Buddhist come and talk to them. Seemed like, but we'll see. I'm still open to it, and because I think it's always good to be able to bring this message, and I mentioned, I think, on the last call, this great thing about the Daniel fast, which is another entree as well. So thanks so much, Nina. It's great to
have you. Oh, thank you.
About all this. Yeah, great. Thanks. All right. So, and then the other thing I want to just reemphasize again, perhaps if you're interested, Steve has been working hard putting on the event that's going to be this weekend. And you can just go to, I think it's Conscious Foods, FOOD, you know, Foods Plural Summit.com, and you'll see Chris Carr and Sherry Soria and Pam Popper and some really well-known people, Bo Rinaldi and Charlotte Gerson, Jameis Sheridan and Brenna Davis. I mean, these are really pretty. Colleen Patrick Goudreau, who's been on our show, and quite a few other well-known. Jill Nussenow, she's a well-known vegetarian cookbook author, and as well as myself, Steve also, and so it's an attempt to bring, and all of these people are all bringing a vegan message. So it's this wonderful first really attempt to bring the vegan message in an online conference way to the mainstream, and through putting it out to as many as we can. So please, if you're interested, have a listen, and it's all free. And if you want to publicize it in some way, tell your friends or tell people about it, that would be great. So we're looking forward to that. I'll be speaking on Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific time for that. And then right soon after that, we're heading off to the Holistic Holiday at Sea. This is another kind of interesting thing. It's a vegan cruise, and for some reason this year, the attendance just exploded. And I always wonder about this kind of thing, why are the attendance on vegan events is never really that big. It was always around 700, maybe 800, and this is a ship that will hold, it's an eco ship, which I have to kind of say that, otherwise we probably wouldn't want to go. It's the most eco ship they have anyway. I guess it's not really eco, but they don't dump any gray water or black water into the water, and they try to recycle, and they've got vegan food. But anyway, it's up to, I think, they had to just turn people, they're turning people away. There's just a waiting list, and it's over 1,300 people. So I see the numbers growing, but I still have to say that when you look at something like the Vegetarian Summer Fest or these other events, the Animal Rights Conference, so the big national events, they typically are always around 700 or 800 people. And then you look at some of these other events, the Christians and the Meat Association and all these other groups, easily will get 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 or 50,000 people to come to an event. I mean, if they, they do that quite often. So I wonder why, in a sense, why we don't do that. But I think maybe it's not necessary. Maybe it's best to work in our communities, but I think it would also be pretty neat to have maybe some big events now and then as well. although I actually do have to say that some of the vegetarian events have gotten pretty huge. So let's see if there's anything else I really wanted to emphasize on this call, because it is getting along here in time. If anyone has any questions, let me know. We are also, let's see, just to let you know, the next call, which is our first Tuesday call, is going to fall right on a time when we are going to be unavailable, because we're going to be actually out at sea somewhere in the Caribbean. And so I wanted to kind of check, because Steve and I and Madeline, we were having a little bit perhaps the feeling that doing two events per month might be a little much for people. I mean, you know, it's quite a lot perhaps to do two events a month. It's not for me, but I mean for you, I know you all are very busy. And so we were thinking perhaps of scaling back to one call per month. And but I'm open to your thoughts and suggestions, your ideas, your comments, and see what you think. And perhaps instead of a call like this, where we're doing, you know, Q&A or, you know, just responding, I could, you know, just do every month, put up either probably an audio, I think, rather than video, but at least an audio responding to questions that are on the forums and things like that. So just let me know what you think about that, because I know we're all very busy, and once a month may be the best, because it seemed like the attendance was dropping off a little bit having two events. It's a lot for people to go to two, to be on two. I know some of you crazy people will probably go to 10 if we if we had 10, but I think for a lot of us it's maybe hard to do more than one. So just let me know what you think about that, because we want to make it work for everybody. And otherwise, you know, check through the resources. There's really a lot of things. I have some things that's pretty self-explanatory, so I won't go over it. But I do encourage everyone to join our Facebook group, and I have the link there, because that's really, there's a lot kind of going on there, just posting, people posting inspiring thoughts or whatever's going on. And then, of course, our forums, I really want to emphasize that as well. Also, my blog post, Your Secret Hideaway, is calling, and I'm writing another one, which will be up soon, about meditation. I think it's good to have one on that, so that'll be going up soon. It's really great to see the Hebrew version of the World Peace Diet now. That is for sale in bookstores, and we have something on that. And there's quite a few other. This month has been really like explosive for animal issues on every level. There's been, I think, probably good and bad, but you know, some people think that what's happening with the Humane Society's thing with the United Egg Producers is really good, and some people think it's really bad. However, there's no denying that the animals are getting into the public, these issues are getting into the public attention. I think that's very important, no matter what, that people just have to think about what they're eating and what and how we're treating animals. That's the most important thing, I think, ultimately, is to just raise consciousness about these things. So raise your hand, press star 2 if you have any other thoughts or questions or concerns about the movement, the vegan message, World Peace Diet. I'd like to welcome a few. We have some new people that are going through the program, and that's great to have them with us. And we have an online, you know, it's an ongoing online World Peace Diet mastery program and facilitator training. So if you know anyone who might want to go deeper, you know, please let them know about it. And if anyone has any other questions or comments before we kind of close down tonight, I would be happy to respond. I will say that on the forums, I noticed that there was some discussion about veganism being expensive, more expensive perhaps than eating at McDonald's or something like that. And one of the things I think it's important to do is to just sort of emphasize two things. One, of course, the huge subsidies that animal agriculture products get, but also that it's very possible to eat a vegan diet on a budget, on a much less expensively, and I just met a few weeks ago when I spoke in Sarasota, Florida, Ellen Jaffe Jones. She's a wonderful, wonderful person, really. I really enjoyed meeting her. She came to the lecture that I gave there at the Unitarian Church and gave me a copy of her book, which is entitled Eat Vegan on $4 a Day. Eat Vegan on $4 a Day. And this book is published by book publishing company At the Farm, which we love, the book publishing company, and we love The Farm. And in fact, I want to remind you all that I will be, Madeline and I together actually will be putting on an event there, a conference in May. We want to start, I guess, letting people know about that pretty soon. So hope you can join us, or if you know people that would like to go through this training, we're going to be offering it at The Farm. At The Farm, I mean, what a place. Gosh, it's legendary, in May. But anyway, this book by her was published by the book publishing company, and it is the largest vegan recipe book publishing company in North America. It's located right there. And she's just got some great ideas about how you can eat healthy food, and a lot of it's organic. She is not quite as a stickler on organic as we are. We really think it's very, very important to eat organic. But pretty much all of her recipes are organic, organic-friendly. Not a lot of processed foods. Processed foods are expensive generally, so buying grains in bulk and so forth, I think, is a really great idea. And we're also pleasantly surprised at this point with Green Polka Dot Box. We just placed our first order, and I'll send a link to that. But you can order vegan and organic foods online now through Green Polka Dot Box. And I see Green Polka Dot Box potentially being one of the only real competitors to Whole Foods to have a massive impact of vegan organic foods to the public, straight to the public, without going through the middleman. So you can buy foods less expensively, and they seem to have their hearts in the right place. So anyway, I'll send out a link on that. But that's another way to eat less expensively, and basically eating less processed foods and being mindful. I think it's not difficult to eat less expensively, so that's not really an excuse. And I guess I'll kind of wrap it up right there because it's getting late. I want to thank all of you for joining us and maybe just close our time with a short prayer for all of us and just give thanks for the ever-abiding spirit of love and peace, joy, freedom, and harmony that is shining not only in our hearts but as the core essential nature of all living beings, that this is our true nature. And although we perhaps find ourselves in circumstances being born and raised in a culture that in many ways forces us to forget or disconnect from this essential truth, we are all on the path of remembering the truth that we are, of reawakening and awakening to the truth that we are, and to working together to help raise consciousness on this beautiful earth, that we can build a world that cares for everyone. There are thousands, millions of points of light, and we're all creating a network of that. And so I just wish you all a wonderful few weeks till we talk again. And please do stay in touch through the ways that we have, email, internet, Facebook, and the forum pages and so forth. And keep rattling those cages and freeing beings. And I know that we're going to be seeing some major changes on this planet, positive changes. There's only good around the corner. It's getting better. Thanks so much for all the work you're doing. And much love to you all. Thanks again.